Are you looking for new books to read? Do you like finding a new special author? Are you tired of the same old books from the same old authors? Well then, welcome to Discovered Wordsmiths, a podcast where you can hear from fantastic new authors. Join Stephen Schneider as he finds and talks to authors you may not know, but authors that have worked hard to write great new books. Hear about their book and why you should check it out. So sit back and listen to today's Discovered Wordsmith.
Hey, welcome to a nice fall edition of Discovered Wordsmiths. I wanted to make a little note on this episode. I talked to Sandy a couple months ago, and we had some issues with the recording. It stopped a couple times. We lost some of it. When I was trying to put this episode together, I realized that a lot of the beginning was gone. So she was gracious enough to get back on, and we recorded the beginning again. So it may sound a little different. There may be a bit of a jump in what we were talking about when it gets to the parts that we already had recorded previously. But I wanted to make sure she got the chance to talk about her book, and we didn't miss anything. So this is a really interesting book. It's a memoir about a trip her family took when she was young, and it's been about 40 some years in the making. So sit back, listen, here's Sandy.
Well, Sandy, welcome back to Discovered Wordsmith. It's a little odd. We had a few technical issues, so I'm glad you could take some time to clear this up and answer the questions that we missed before. So good morning, and how are you doing?
I'm well, and thank you for redoing this. I really appreciate it, too.
Yeah, great. This is kind of weird. It's almost like a second interview, but we're doing all the first interview stuff. Tell us a bit about who you are and where you're from and some of the things you like to do outside of writing.
I was born and grew up in Alaska. I lived there for 35 years and never had lived anywhere else except for a year as an exchange student until I was about 35. So Alaska was just normal life for me. As a kid, I was very unfamiliar with, you know, the rest of the world, and I never traveled outside of Alaska very much in my childhood. And I now live in Western Washington on the Olympic Peninsula. It's a beautiful place, a lot like Alaska, but not with the winter that Alaska has. And I'm glad to be here and not there. This time of life, I enjoy doing a lot of traveling, which have been kind of squashed the last couple of years, but I have been able to see family members at least a few times. So that's been good.
Yeah. And Alaska is one of the few places I would love to get to that I haven't been. I mean, there's probably quite a few, but one of them that I feel is realistic. My parents went there, and I have a friend that from school that still lives up there. What part of Alaska did you live in?
I was born in Seward, which is on the south coast and kind of central Alaska. I lived on the Kenai Peninsula, which is where Seward is, and Anchorage most of my time up there. I did spend 1 year in Fairbanks, going my first year of college. And my dad had grown up in Fairbanks from about 12 or 13 years old. And I thought it would be fun to go up there, but when it got to 74 below zero, I said, no, I'm heading south again. I'm going down to southern Alaska, where it was more tolerable temperatures for me.
Yeah, I don't blame you there. Now your book, we'll get to in a moment. Why did you want to write this book? What got you started writing?
Well, I've been a writer for a long time, and I've always loved writing. Early in my early adulthood, I was involved in a few nonprofit kind of and volunteer organizations, and I was always the one who did the newsletter. I loved doing it. Nobody else ever wanted to do it. And I just have enjoyed written communications. I've done freelance writing for newspapers, feature articles and business articles and that kind of thing. But this was my first book-length project to be published. I've worked on a couple other historical novels that haven't been published.
Tell us about the book. What's it called? And tell us a little bit about it.
The name of the book is The Drive in 65. And it takes place in 1965. It's a memoir about a 22,000-mile camping trip, basically. My mom and her sister, their family had moved to Alaska from New York in 1945. And so by the time they married and started having kids in the 50s and 60s, they hadn't seen their cousins back at New York in 20 years. And so they planned this trip. They started dreaming about it about 1962 and gave us plenty of time to plan for it, included the kids in a lot of the planning. They always wanted to include where we wanted to go as well as the things they wanted to do. Then in May 22nd of 1965, we had purchased a van for the trip. It was my mom, her sister, their mother, and their combined five kids, myself and my two siblings and our two cousins. And so eight of us in a 9-passenger van with no seat belts and no air conditioning, loaded to the gills with enough, you know, gear for camping. It was like a kind of a Beverly Hillbillies looking outfit on a camping trip for 3.5 months.
And at the time, mid-60s, it would probably be very unusual to have a couple women with a bunch of kids traveling that much.
Well, they were mocked and scorned in the planning stages by almost everybody they knew. Their husbands never relented of telling them they're never going to make it to the Canadian border, and they will, you know, they'll be back in a week, and wouldn't admit that, you know, that two single women in their 30s were capable of this kind of adventure. And they just, they didn't take any of that to heart. They had this dream and they were going to carry it out, and they did. And I think that's one of the real takeaways of this book, is that when you've got a dream, don't let people talk you out of it. It may be the life-changing experience that we had on the Drive in 65.
If I remember right, the first time we talked, you had a couple interesting stories of some things you ran into, partly because you had a couple women with a bunch of kids, but also some things that are pertinent today with racism. Share a story or so with us.
Well, in my school experience, and I was 13 at that time, so, you know, I was in seventh grade, I had not had Black classmates. Anchorage was by and large a very white population. There were some Alaskan natives, but we had seen a lot of the news, you know, on TV, news about the Civil Rights Act and the rioting and things that we saw going on in other parts of the country, and had no context for understanding that at all. And when we got to the South on this trip, and I especially remember driving through Georgia, and there were people living in shacks alongside the road and selling watermelons and baskets that they'd woven and whatnot. And that was evidently their only means of support. And they were just starving and poor. And, you know, we were shocked and horrified that this was happening in America. And then we, you know, we saw whites only signs on bathrooms, and that kind of thing was still in evidence in 1965. And it became clear to us why people were willing to defy the police and protest. It certainly seemed a very sensible thing to protest once we realized the circumstances.
Right. So this book, you've had the idea for a while before you actually wrote it. And you said there was some letters and things that brought back the whole book. Tell us a bit about your research and delving back into this time frame.
Yeah, I wasn't really the one that was supposed to write this book. My mom and aunt, from the very beginning when they began planning, intended to write a book about it. And that's why they insisted that my dad and uncle save all the letters that they sent home, every letter and postcard. And they also saved and mailed home brochures and maps and various paraphernalia we collected along the way that would, and we had a journal. My mom wrote in a journal almost every day, and my aunt kept a ledger of our expenses. So we had, they had accumulated a lot of resources to write from, but the two of them never did get that project off the ground. They had envisioned a different kind of book than I wrote, but when I had always, I mean, this was a trip that changed my life and my siblings and my cousins. So it was important to me to save the story, if only for family memories. But when my aunt passed away in 2013, I got her stash of archives of the Drive-In 65, and my mom said, oh, I've got another box somewhere. And so I began writing on the book pretty seriously about 2016 or 2015. And then my mom passed away in 2017, and I found what she and I had looked for her materials but couldn't find them. And when we went through her things, we found the rest of the Drive-In 65 archives. And I was so delighted to be able to tell that story, share not only the great adventure we had, because you can imagine what, you know, the eight of us crammed into that van and rumbling around the country was like. Some people might find it a nightmare scenario. I actually only remember like one or two arguments on the whole trip, and I'm sure that's the selective memory at work. But right. We had a wonderful time, and it is one of those experiences that never leaves you. It was important for me to save that, but it's also an adventure story and a real inspiring story of living out a dream and the impact that can have. So I finished it in early 2020 and went through the process of getting it edited. I looked for an agent for a while, but you know, it's a long process, and I was frankly just impatient. I wanted to get the project closed up. So I self-published it in July of last year.
The correlation between what's happening in our country today and what you ran into back then, it's almost like a bookend of time. I definitely, from what you've talked about with the book, it sounds like a great coming of age story almost. I could see this as a movie with, you know, this trip.
I'd love to see it as a movie too, but I think you're right. It's it has a lot to say today. You know, 1965 not only had all the civil rights things going on, but it was one of the biggest years of escalation of the war in Vietnam. And we've certainly had some Vietnam comparisons to modern, you know, current day history with what's gone on in the Middle East. So I think there are lessons for today in there. And one thing I was surprised about was how much research I needed to do. You think of writing a memoir as, you know, you're writing about something you lived through and you're just writing it from your memories. But of course, this happened 50 some years ago, and I was only 13. So my perspective has changed. I did have to research a lot of the historical things to get the timeline right. I had, of course, the dates on our letters and things, but I've tried to include the context of 1965. So what was the music, you know, what we know as classic rock today, that was new music then. And so we, you know, we were hearing some of that for the first time. I was surprised at how much research was needed.
But you do have the letters that you worked from. So it's not a fiction piece. It's definitely a nonfiction memoir. It's a snapshot in time. I think very historically significant. So the fact that you finally wrote this and brought it out, I think is wonderful. And that's one of the great things about the publishing world today is we have a lot of writers probably with stories like this that they could tell.
Yes. It's an important view of the 1960s, not only for those historical events we've mentioned, but also a view of women's roles in that time in history. Fact that my mom and aunt couldn't get a credit card in their own name. Women could, in a lot of places, could not serve on a jury in 1965. They still had not opened the, you know, many of the Ivy League universities to women, except in exceptional circumstances. It was a very different world, and I think that contributed to the doubts people had about my mom and aunt. We drove all the way to Mexico City. You know, that's like we're going into a country where we didn't speak the language, although my aunt and I had a year of Spanish each. So we thought we would be fine. And that resulted in some comical interchanges with the policemen in a couple of cases.
But did you traditionally publish this, find an agent, or did you independently publish it?
I published this independently. That was quite a learning curve. I had talked with some agents about it. The unpublished version, I entered in a contest and won this a Cascade Award from Oregon Christian Writers, which was real encouraging to me in 2019. I knew the, you know, long shot it was to get a memoir published, and yet I felt that there was more of an audience than just my family for it. That's actually what I started writing it for, is to preserve a family story that had moved into the realm of legend and amongst my big extended family. So I self-published it and launched in July of 2020.
You wanted to preserve it, family and all that, but you released it so others can enjoy it also. Do you know of any other memoirs that are similar to this? If somebody says, I like that, so I might like Sandra's.
Well, there are certainly quite a few travel memoirs. And I found a group on Facebook that has really been a wonderful group to participate in. It's called We Love Memoirs, and it's made up of mostly readers of memoirs and quite a few writers, about maybe a tenth of the group of 6,000 or so members. And although an author cannot directly promote their own writing there, the group itself promotes memoirs in many different ways. And I found a lot of people who really enjoyed reading it. I've got good reviews on Amazon, about 60 reviews.
Oh, that's good. That's
nice. By and far, very positive reviews.
So people are enjoying it outside of the family.
Oh, they definitely are. Yes. And it's been really fun for me to see that happening. You know, launching in the middle of the pandemic was a big challenge, and I wasn't able to do public events like I had hoped to. I found some ways to work around that and did a Facebook Live launch party. It was a lot of fun, just an hour on Facebook with the help of a couple of friends. There were about 50 people that tuned in during the party. But since then, it's been viewed more than 600 times. So I was a little skeptical about how, you know, valuable it might be, but it's had a lot of play, and it was fun to do. I've been able to get on some radio shows and podcasts here and there, a few other, personal ways of sharing about the book, and it's been well received. So that's been real satisfying.
I love how you kind of bookended the whole thing. The trip started right after some major legalization or, you know, law changes in regards to discrimination and things like that. And you released it when we have a huge pandemic, which, you know, didn't discriminate whatsoever. It's just two very tumultuous times in the country. And yes. your book kind of is right there with both ends.
Yes. And I think, you know, the civil rights, what we call in, historically the civil rights era of the 60s, is clearly not over yet in our country. So I think some of the things that we experienced in that regard are relevant to readers today.
Because of that, especially, but do you think this would make a good movie or TV show?
I think that there are ways it would. The real message of the book doesn't have so much to do with what was happening and where we went and what we did, as much as my mom and aunt, who are the heroes of the story, living out a dream, taking a chance on something. People told them they were crazy to be, you know, driving clear around the country with just the kids, not taking any men with them. You know, what was going to happen when the car broke down? Well, these are, you know, Alaska women. They were not afraid of that happening. In fact, the second morning we woke up in freezing Yukon territory, we had two flat tires that we had to change in the freezing cold. But those were obstacles that they knew they could overcome. And just their courage to step out into an adventure that people didn't think was something even feasible or possible for them, and doing it in a big way and coming back with a wonderful story of adventure. That's the real story of encouraging people to not give up on their dreams or not be talked out of them by naysayers, but go for it.
Writing this, obviously, it wasn't like you were planning on being a full-time writer for your whole life. But now that you've written this, do you have any plans to write any more?
Well, I think, you know, I was 13 in 1965, so my age is pretty obvious. And I have been a writer for a lot of my life, just not on book length things. I'm still working on some historical fiction. But, you know, I'm really drawn to nonfiction writing. And I do genealogy with one of my sisters. And there are a lot of stories in our family history farther back and events that took place then that really attract me as far as topics to write about. So I don't have any shortage of material and I'll keep writing.
Okay, great.
And I should say too, this book is written under a pen name, Sandra Lynn Reed, which was my maiden name. And that's how it can be found if someone's searching for it. I will say that having a pen name is a little split personality kind of problem for me, and I would probably not do that again if I was to go back and start over.
Got it. Okay, so you're not a big proponent of the pseudonym.
Well, right. Not for the reasons I did it. My legal name, my married name is Frickholm. It's spelled funny. It doesn't sound like it looks. It doesn't spell like it sounds. And I thought this is going to be easier to just use my maiden name. But I have found it to be more of a hassle than I think it's worth.
Okay. Well, that's interesting because I know with my last name of Schneider, I know Jim has been pushing me that I should use a different pen name because I use S.A. Schneider, and I've resisted that also. But he's still saying, yeah. I mean, you know, he's just saying, hey, you really might want to think about it.
Yeah.
So interesting. All right. So Sandy, do you have any favorite books and authors that you like to read?
Oh, sure, I do. I usually read historical fiction. I also sometimes read memoir, but and some contemporary fiction. I read really a variety of things. But in historical fiction, one of my very favorites is Susanna Kearsley, who writes sort of a little bit paranormal, but not much. just a little touch of it. And also Laura France and Lori Benton are both like in the inspirational market. They are great writers. Personally, I'm writing in my historical fiction in the 13th and 14th century in the Mediterranean area. And I recently found another author, Jane Ann McLaughlin, who has written a series of books set then. So she's my new best friend.
That's cool. I love that about authors. They're a lot, most of the time, they're a lot less pretentious than movie actors. So it's a lot easier to reach out and talk to an author, even if you feel a little humbled by their experiences.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
And I love that tagline, a little bit of paranormal, but not much. I think that's a great tagline. Somebody needs to use that. So before we go get done with the first half of the podcast, can you tell everybody listening why they should get your book?
Well, we've all been kind of holed up, or many of us, just stuck at home. And so here's a great travel adventure you can enjoy while you're still at home. It's a way to take a road trip without all those miles on the road if you don't care for being on the road. And it is an inspiring story of following your dreams.
Well, it sounds like a great thing. And I bet it was great to relive the adventure that you had through this writing and share it with others. So Sandy, I appreciate you taking some time to talk to us about your book. Don't go away, because we're going to talk some author stuff about publishing coming right up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Discovered Wordsmiths. Come back next week and listen to another author discuss the road they've traveled, and maybe sometime in the near future, it might be you.